and welcome to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Friday, March 19th. I'm your reader, Erin, and our first article on the front page. Clear Lake budget okayed without comment. 2022 spending plan vote unanimous by Ashley Stewart, Globe Gazette. It's official. The Clear Lake City Council unanimously approved the city's fiscal year 2022 budget Monday evening after a public hearing where no written or verbal comments were made. Quote, "We are required by law to set a budget and live within that, and I think it's a wonderful situation and a wonderful process," end quote, said Mike Callanan, Clear Lake at-large councilman and mayor pro term. Quote, "At the national level, that doesn't seem to happen, and the numbers in my lifetime have become astronomic, but I do, from my own involvement here, applaud the process of municipal governments that set a budget and then work real hard to make that. I think that's a very good process, and I guess I'm proud of being part of that," end quote. The councilman's actions came 2 weeks after it approved the maximum property tax levy for fiscal year 2022 at $9.70 per $1,000 taxable property valuation. Fiscal year 2022 marks the sixth consecutive year the city's tax levy has declined or remained the same. In fiscal year 2017, the city tax rate decreased from $10.54 to $10.04. For fiscal year 2018, the tax rate declined from $10.04 to $9.80. And for fiscal year 2019, the tax rate decreased from $9.80 to $9.70. The approved fiscal year 2022 budget is nearly $14.9 million, with $9.7 million going toward operations and maintenance, $4.5 million going toward capital, and about $706,228 going to debt service. Clear Lake City Administrator Scott Flory said earlier this month that he proposed the budget is, quote, "a little less fiscally aggressive," end quote, than the amended fiscal year 2021 budget of about $18.6 million, which he said was the city's largest budget in his time as administrator. Some of the capital projects slated for fiscal year 2022 are the park expansion project on South 15th Street, an alley improvement project, and the initial stages for South Lakeview Drive. The capital purchases include two patrol cars, equipment and furniture for the wellness center, a skid loader and trailer, and a utility truck and pickup truck. The projected ending cash balance in the general fund in fiscal year 2022 is nearly $5 million, which is comparable to Mason City's, a community nearly three times its size, Flory said. Quote, "I mentioned at the last meeting that is a really outstanding level to have in reserve," end quote, he said. Quote, "That's about 62% of our general fund operating budget," end quote. The 2022 fiscal year runs from July 1st, 2021 to June 31st, 2022. Our next front page article, Mason City Council OKs 2022 budget, developers present vision for Willow Creek Riverwalk by Jared McNett, Globe Gazette. Mason City now has its budget for the next year. Tuesday night, the Mason City Council unanimously approved the spending plan for fiscal year 2022, which includes more than $41 million in capital projects, such as River City Renaissance work and street improvements all across town. At the top of the discussion on the agenda item, as well as just before voting on it, multiple city officials signaled what it could mean for residents beyond just upgrades to where they live. Quote, "It reduces overall levy by 36 cents, end quote, Mason City Mayor Bill Sheckles said. At-large Councilmember Paul Adams later echoed him, saying, quote, "City taxes are slightly decreasing. That's important to call out and repeat," end quote. In a presentation to fellow city officials, City Finance Director Kevin Jacobson spelled out how much of the budget is claimed by what sort of spending. According to Jacobson, 35.81% of the fiscal year 2022 budget is tied up in capital projects, not just the $12.2 million for the River City Renaissance work, but also $15 million for Mason City Municipal Airport improvements coming through the Federal CARES Act, $2.3 million for North Monroe Avenue paving, $1 million for water projects, and about $400,000 to Mason City Parks and Recreation. A little more than $750,000 is also budgeted for the Mason City Multipurpose Arena. Quote, "We're getting a better sense of what costs are going to be there, and quote, Jacobson said. As far as revenues go, Jacobson told city officials that the largest source would be intergovernmental funds, including about $16 million from federal grants. Jacobson said that another $16 million would come from so-called, quote, enterprise charges, end quote, such as water, sewer, sanitation, ambulance, and the multipurpose arena. While accounting for spending and revenue sources, the presentation also included a note on the city's current debt limit. Per Jacobson's count, the city's ceiling is about $97 million, and it still has the capacity for about $67 million for more worth of debt. In total, from fiscal year 2021 to fiscal year 2022, the overall budget went up by about $13 million. A river walk for River City? To kickstart the night, Berglund and Cram's Christy King presented city officials with a vision of what the planned Willow Creek River Walk could ultimately look like. Quote, this product is to enhance and supplement what is already great about Mason City, end quote, King said. King said the architectural firm's tentative plans for the area are organized in a musical sense to keep with Mason City's past and to give recreationalists a sense of rhythm and composition. When the outro for such a song might be is up in the air to a degree, but King's presentation it did suggest construction sometime in 2022. During the actual discussion on awarding a contract to Berglund and Cram for professional services, which was unanimously approved, the major concern that arose for council members was the possibility of flooding. Adams asked what the history for that specific area had been. According to Director of Development Services Stephen Van Steenhuis, where the project is being considered is outside of the floodplain. City Administrator Aaron Burnett pointed out a moderate degree of flooding could be allowable for project. Quote, this being a park space, you could build it to be able to be flooded on the lower levels, but flooding is always going to have to be a consideration, end quote, he said. Time at last for a hotel? One of the city's projects that has been most disrupted by the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic has been work on the downtown hotel as a part of the larger River City Renaissance. When the city council approved a development agreement with Gatehouse Capital in July 2019, one stipulation was that, quote, on or before July 1st, 2020, end quote, construction on the hotel property and the Music Man Square had to be bearing, quote, unavoidable delays, end quote. After a year of pushbacks, the city is coming forward with a new timeline. Now the plan is for a hotel closing now later than July 1 of this year. Quote, the original agreement allows for unforeseeable events, but unfortunately, we thought we'd be able to move a little bit quicker through this, end quote, Burnett said during council discussion on an item to set a public hearing of April 6 for amending the hotel agreement. He then pointed out that the sooner the project can get to construction stage, the better, because such costs are on the rise. That item was unanimously approved by the city council, and in voting for it, First Ward Council Member John Lee said that he took the change as a positive. Quote, I'm just glad this is on the document. To me, it seems like something's moving, end quote. Our last front page article, work continues on new Clear Lake welcome signs. City working with DOT, signs set to be done by end of April, by Ashley Stewart, Globe Gazette. The city of Clear Lake is still hoping to have its new welcome signs installed before the end of April, ahead of its tourism season. Clear Lake City Administrator Scott Flory told the city council Monday evening that city officials are currently working with the Iowa Department of Transportation, the agency that regulates signage along highways, on the new signs. Quote, we'd like to get started on these obviously fairly soon, but we want to do it right as well, end quote, he said. Quote, the DOT is pretty strict about signs within their right-of-way, so there's a number of criteria that we have to meet. We want to make sure that that's okay with them before we start, and then that one will kind of drive the other locations as well, end quote. In January, the council approved the purchase and installation of 4 new welcome signs, including 2 with LED video boards and 2 without them, from LRI Graphics and Signs of Grimes for $87,061. The signs will replace those at the city's main entrances, North 24th Street and U.S. Highway 18, 8th Street and U.S. Highway 18, Buddy Holly Place and U.S. Highway 18, and 4th Avenue South near Team Quest Corp. Of the three existing signs believed to be installed sometime in the early to mid-1990s, the city has only been able to locate a permit or easement for one of them, Flory said. The sign at 8th Street and U.S. Highway 18 is also currently located in the railroad right-of-way. Quote, that's a little bit of a challenge for us, he said. We've had some conversations with the railroad, the DOT. We want to make sure that we're good to go, permitted, all the T's are crossed and I's are dotted before we start putting some signs down, end quote. Flory said the city needs to make sure its proposed signs aren't in conflict or incompatible with the manual on uniform traffic control devices, as well as the Federal Highway Administration's rules and regulations on signage before it proceeds. He hopes to hear from the Iowa DOT within the next week. The new welcome signs are the culmination of conversations between city staff and the Clear Lake Area Chamber of Commerce over the last couple of years to update Clear Lake's entryways to better promote the events and activities the community proudly hosts and celebrates its success. The signs proposed at the 8th Street, North 24th Street, and 4th Avenue South will read, quote, Welcome to Clear Lake, end quote, and feature nautical elements like dock posts and rope with a failed stone base to complement the improvements made at the seawall downtown. The sign at the entrance to Surf District, which comprises the area surrounding the historic Surf Ballroom and Museum, will read, quote, Welcome to Clear Lake's Surf District, end quote, and feature a nod to the area's strong rock and roll ties with two metal guitars. Last year, said the Buddy Holly Place sign hasn't been finalized yet. The signs with the 4x10-foot single-sided LED video board will appear at the 8th Street and Buddy Holly Place locations, while the static signs will be installed at North 24th Street and 4th Avenue South. The Clear Lake City Council's next meeting is at 6 p.m. Monday, April 5th at City Hall, 15 North 6th Street. Moving to page A2 for local news, Project Gratitude to Come to Mason City Central Park by Melanie Mergen, Globe Gazette. Main Street Mason City is partnering up with KCMR Radio to host a demonstration of gratitude. Quote, Project Gratitude, end quote, will be held Saturday, August 7th from 10 a.m. to noon in Mason City Central Park. The park will be filled with signs expressing single words that reflect the community's gratitude and positivity. Businesses, organizations, faith groups, or individuals interested in participating or learning more information can email Ozzie Ohl at KCMRradio@OZZIE@KCMRFM.com. Our next article, deadline approaching for grant, Globe Gazette staff. The deadline to apply for a Cerro Gordo County Community Foundation grant is fast approaching. Those who wish to be considered for the 2021 grant cycle should submit their applications by 11:59 p.m. on Thursday, April 1. Grants are available for projects in the following areas: arts and culture, community betterment, education and youth development, environment and animal welfare, health and human service. Grant applications must be a 501c3 organization or a government entity serving Cerro Gordo County. Before applying, first-time applicants are encouraged to contact Dottie Thompson, Program Manager for the Community Foundation of Northeast Iowa, by calling 319-243-1358. Grant recipients will be announced in June 2021. In 2020, $124,761.37 in grants were awarded to 40 nonprofits and government agency projects serving Cerro Gordo County. The Cerro Gordo County Community Foundation has awarded more than $1.6 million in grants. For more information, contact the Community Foundation of Northeast Iowa at 319-287-9106. In state news, House GOP pushes through constitutional carry gun bill. Opponents, it could make state less safe, by James Q. Lynch, special to the Globe Gazette, Des Moines. Legislation to eliminate the requirement that Iowans get a, quote, permission slip, end quote, from the government to buy a handgun would actually result in more background checks regardless where the weapon is purchased. Proponents of a, quote, constitutional carry, end quote, measure asserted Wednesday. House File 576 approved 60-37, with Representative Wes Breckinridge of Newton, the only Democrat to join Republicans in favor, is part of an agenda that long has been a goal for gun rights advocates and, quote, freedom-loving Iowans, end quote, according to Judiciary Committee Chair Steve Holt, Republican of Denison. By increasing their Iowa House majority to 59-41 in the 2020 election, Republicans had the votes this session to easily pass the measure. Quote, Democrats support the Second Amendment, end quote, Representative Beth Weisel Crochelle, Democrat of Ames, said. However, she argued that the bill would weaken Iowa's current background check system that has blocked nearly 15,000 illegal sales between 1998 and 2019. Background checks, quote, keep firearms out of the hands of felons, domestic abusers, and those who have serious mental health disorders, end quote, she said. Repealing Iowa's background check law and the permitting requirement for carrying a concealed gun is, quote, extreme, it is unpopular, and it is a threat to public safety, end quote, Wessel Crochelle said. But Holt called her criticism, quote, utterly inaccurate, end quote. Instead, he said the measure would, quote, absolutely increase background checks, end quote. Quote, no background checks are eliminated, or I wouldn't be supporting it, end quote, he said. Opponents also warned the bill would make it easy for felons, domestic abusers, and people prohibited based on basis of mental illnesses to buy handguns. HF756 said Moms Demand Action would make it legal for people, including people with dangerous histories, to carry hidden loaded handguns in public in Iowa without a permit or safety training. The bill recognizes the constitutional right to keep and bear arms and, according to the Iowa Firearms Coalition, one of three groups backing the proposal, means Iowa will, quote, no longer treat the free exercise of this basic right as a mere privilege, end quote. The beneficiaries of the bill would be a woman fleeing an abusive partner or the victim of a dangerous stalker, quote, who needs to arm themselves now, end quote, because they won't have to, quote, wait for a government permission slip, end quote, the Firearms Coalition said. But calling it, quote, constitutional carry, end quote, doesn't make the bill constitutional. University of Iowa constitutional law professor Representative Christina Bohannon said, quote, you can call this bill constitutional carry all you want, but the Constitution doesn't carry this bill, end quote, the Iowa City Democrat said, referring to U.S. Supreme Court rulings that states can place restrictions on the Second Amendment. Quote, what this shows is that with every passing year, pro-gun laws in Iowa are becoming more and more extreme, Bohannon said. Common sense gun safety legislation supported by overwhelming majority of Iowans is going away, end quote. Removing the requirement to get a state permit to carry a concealed weapon jeopardizes safety training sessions for gun owners, said Representative Mary Wolfe of Democrat of Clinton. That rule, quote, ensures that everybody carrying a firearm in Iowa has at least a rudimentary knowledge of our laws surrounding self-defense and basic gun safety, and that is a good thing, end quote. Looking back, today is Friday, March 19th, the 78th day of 2021. There are 287 days left in the year. Today's highlight in history, on March 19th, 2013, Pope Francis officially began his ministry as the 266th Pope, receiving the ring symbolizing the papacy and a wool stole exemplifying his role as shepherd of his 1.2 billion strong flock during a mass at the Vatican. On this date in 1931, Nevada Governor Fred B. Bowser signed a measure legalizing casino gambling. In 1942, during World War II, President Franklin D. Roosevelt ordered men between the ages of 45 and 64, inclusive, to register for non-military duty. In 1945, during World War II, 724 people were killed when a Japanese dive bomber attacked the carrier USS Franklin off Japan. The ship was saved. Adolf Hitler ordered the destruction of German facilities that could fall into Allied hands in his so-called, quote, Nero Decree, end quote, which was largely disregarded. In 1962, Bob Dylan's first album, titled Bob Dylan, was released by Columbia Records. In 1966, the Texas Western Miners defeated the heavily favored Kentucky Wildcats 72-65 to win the NCAA championship played in College Park, Maryland. Making the contest especially noteworthy was that Texas Western became the first basketball team to start 5 five black players in a national title game as it faced an all-white Kentucky squad. In 1977, the series finale of Mary Tyler Moore aired on CBS TV, ending the situation comedy's seven-season run. In 1979, the U.S. House of Representatives began televising its floor proceedings. The live feed was carried by C-SPAN, Cable Satellite Public Affairs Network, which was making its debut. In 1987, televangelist Jim Baker resigned as chairman of his PTL ministry organization amid a sex and money scandal involving Jessica Hahn, a former church secretary. In 1991, Polish President Lech Walesa arrived in Washington for his first state visit to the United States. In 1993, Supreme Court Justice Byron R. White announced plans to retire. White's departure paved the way for Ruth Bader Ginsburg to become the court's second female justice. In 2003, President George W. Bush ordered the start of war against Iraq. Because of the time difference, it was early March 20th in Iraq. In 2014, Toyota agreed to pay $1.2 billion to settle an investigation by the U.S. government, admitting that it had hidden information about defects that caused Toyota and Lexus vehicles to accelerate unexpectedly, resulting in injuries and deaths. 10 years ago, the U.S. fired more than 100 cruise missiles from the sea while French fighter jets targeted Muammar Gaddafi's forces from the air, launching the broadest international military effort since the Iraq War in support of an uprising. President Barack Obama arrived in Brazil for the start of a 3-country, 5-day tour of Latin America. Our next article, U.S. near vaccine milestone, 100M shots goal to be hit Friday, Associated Press, Washington. With the U.S. closing in on President Joe Biden's goal of injecting 100 million coronavirus vaccinations weeks ahead of his target date, officials announced on Thursday the nation is now in position to help supply neighbors Canada and Mexico. The Biden administration announced the outlines of a plan to, quote, loan, end quote, vaccines to Canada and Mexico, even as the president announced that the U.S. is on the cusp of meeting his 100-day injection goal, quote, way ahead of schedule, end quote. Quote, I'm proud to announce that tomorrow, 58 days into our administration, we will have met our goal, end quote, Biden said Thursday. Meanwhile, the European Union's Drug Regulatory Agency said Thursday that the AstraZeneca vaccine doesn't increase the overall incidence of blood clots and that the benefits of using it outweigh the possible risks, paving the way for European countries to resume dispensing the shot. France, Italy, and Germany promptly announced they will start using the vaccine again on Friday. Spain, Portugal, and the Netherlands said they will do so next week, though Spain said it might exclude certain groups to minimize any danger. More than a dozen nations around the world had suspended their use of the vaccine over the past week, following reports of clots in a few dozen of the millions of people across Europe who have gotten the shot. The question was whether the vaccine had anything to do with the clots and whether any action needed to be taken. Ahead of Biden's remarks, the White House announced the U.S. is making plans to send a combined 4 million doses of the AstraZeneca COVID-19 vaccine to Mexico and Canada in its first export of shots. A total of 2.5 million doses will be distributed to Mexico and 1.5 million to Canada. The details are still being worked out. Quote, our first priority remains vaccinating the U.S. population, end quote, Biden's press secretary Jen Psaki said, but she added that, quote, ensuring our neighbors can contain the virus is a mission critical step, is mission critical to ending the pandemic, end quote. The AstraZeneca vaccine has not been authorized for use in the U.S., but has been by the World Health Organization. Tens of millions of doses have been stockpiled in the U.S. should they receive emergency use authorization, and that has sparked an international outcry. Biden has fielded a direct request from Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and Mexican President Andre Manuel Lopez Obrador to buy vaccines made in the United States. Our next article, Putin tears into American ills. Vladimir Iskakhanov, Associated Press, Moscow. President Vladimir Putin responded Thursday to U.S. President Joe Biden's description of the Russian leader as a killer by citing America's past and present troubles from slavery and the slaughter of Native Americans to racial injustice. Biden was asked in an interview this week whether he thought Putin was a killer, and he replied, quote, I do, end quote, a remark that prompted Russia to recall its ambassador in Washington for consultations and warn about further retaliation. Biden has taken a tough stance on Russia, saying that the days of the U.S., quote, rolling over, end quote, to Putin are done, contrasting his style with the approach of former President Donald Trump, who avoided direct confrontation and frequently spoke about Putin with approval. Putin was asked about Biden's comment during a video call marking the anniversary of Russia's 2014 annexation of Crimea, and he responded with an, quote, it takes one to know one, end quote, style remark, saying his counterpart's words reflected the United States' own problems. At the same time, he offered to have a phone call with Biden to discuss issues of mutual interest. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said Thursday that Biden will continue to look to work with Putin on areas of mutual concern, such as efforts to stem Iran's nuclear program and more broadly, nuclear non-proliferation. But she said that Biden is, quote, not going to hold back, end quote, when he is concerned about Putin's actions. Psaki added that Biden did not regret referring to Putin as a killer and pushed back against suggestions that the rhetoric was unhelpful. Quote, President Biden has known President Putin for a long time, Psaki said. They've both been on the global stage for a long time, worked through many iterations of a relationship between the United States and Russia, and he believes we can continue to do that, end quote. Moving to the obituaries, James L. Vierkant, V-I-E-R-K-A-N-T, February 14th, 1968 to March 15th, 2021, Sumner. James L. Vierkant, 53, of Sumner, died unexpectedly Monday, March 15th, 2020, at his home. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, March 23rd, 2021, at Immaculate Conception Catholic Church in Sumner, with Reverend Donald Kumbo officiating. For those unable to attend the service, please join the family via Facebook Live on Becker, Milnes, and Reddick Facebook page on Tuesday at 10:30 a.m. Burial with military rites will be at the Iowa Veterans Cemetery in Adel at 12 p.m. on Wednesday, March 24th. Visitation will be from 4 p.m. to 7 p.m. Monday, March 22nd at Becker Milnes Funeral Home in Sumner, and for 1 hour preceding services at the church on Tuesday. Memorials may be made to the family for later designation. Masks and social distancing will be required at the visitation and the service. James Lawrence, son of James Henry Vierkant and J. Shay Woodsmall, was born February 14, 1968 in Mason City, Iowa. He spent his childhood in Mason City and Mountain Home, Arkansas, and graduated from Mountain Home High School in 1986. Following high school, James continued his education at NIACC in Mason City prior to graduating from Iowa State University with a degree in engineering. On October 9, 1999, he was united in marriage with Sherry Rink in Griswold, Iowa. To this union, a daughter was born, Haley. The couple lived in West Union, Columbus, Nebraska, and Dyersville prior to making their home in Sumner in 2007. James was an engineer with John Deere in Waterloo for many years. He served in the Iowa Air National Guard in 1987 and did so for many years prior to the Kansas Air National Guard, where he earned Lieutenant Colonel. James was a proud member of Thomas E. Wood's Post No. 223, American Legion of Sumner. He enjoyed taking long trips on his motorcycle, attending Weird Al Yankovic concerts with his daughter, and his weekly Dungeons & Dragons game. James is survived by his wife, Sherry of Sumner, daughter Haley of Sumner, stepmother Connie Vierkant of Thornton, father-in-law Phil Rink of Griswold, brother-in-law Brian Rink of Griswold, two sisters-in-law Megan, spouse of Bobby Vasquez of Missouri Valley, and Tracy Rink of Atlantic, and nieces and nephews Aiden and Kira Rink and Nelson and Hazel Vasquez. He was preceded in death by his mother, J. Shay Woodsmall, in March of 2017, father James Henry Vierkant in October of 2020, and mother-in-law Candace Rink in January of 2017. Richard L. Fairbanks, August 28th, 1921 to March 16th, 2021, Mason City. Richard L. Fairbanks, 99 of Mason City, passed away Tuesday, March 16th, 2021 at Good Shepherd Health Center. Memorial services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, March 20th, 2021 at the St. James Lutheran Church with Pastor Sid Bowles officiating. Interment will follow in the Elmwood Cemetery. Visitation will be held from 4 until 6 p.m. Friday, March 19th, 2021, at the Major Erickson Funeral Home, 111 North Pennsylvania Avenue, Mason City. Online condolences may be left for the family at www.majorericksonfuneralhome.com. Richard, known as Dick Lyle Fairbanks, was born August 28, 1921 in Monticello, Iowa, the son of Harry and Florence Hubbard Fairbanks. He was baptized and confirmed in Monticello. Richard attended schools in Monticello and Mason City, graduating in the class of 1940. He played football for MCHS and Mason City Junior College, NIACC. On April 5, 1947, Richard was united in marriage to Belua Nearing Eichmann. Dick and Belua farmed in the Mason City, Riceville, and Clear Lake areas. Dick was an avid bowler and added golfing to his hobbies in his later years. He enjoyed having coffee at Pro's and Hardee's with his friends. Dick and Belua wintered in Texas for 22 years because he loved visiting Texas in his younger years. Dick loved a good joke and was quick to tease his grandchildren. He was an active member of St. James Lutheran Church for 73 years. Those thankful for having shared in Richard's life include his children, Patricia, spouse Glenn Grandy, Julie, spouse Bob Carpenter, Brad, spouse Pat Fairbanks, grandchildren, Brenda, spouse Earl Smith, Tony, spouse Deb Plague, Sherry Knowlton, Amber Pooh, Trevor Grandy, Regina Grandy, Jennifer Kiefer, Eric spouse Katie Kiefer, Jared spouse Jennifer Fairbanks, Ben spouse Mackenzie Ebling, Sarah spouse Kyle Peterson, Addie spouse Will Albrecht, great-grandchildren Ryan Smith, Ashley Plague, Alex spouse Courtney Knowlton, Rayanne Knowlton, Cooper Pogg, Cora Kiefer, Harrison Fairbanks, Nora Fairbanks, Avery Ebling, Henry Ebling, Bryn Peterson, Leo Peterson, Sailor Albrecht, great-great-grandchildren Elijah Bernhardt and Zanna Plague. He is also survived by his sister, Doris Groh. Richard was preceded in death by his parents, wife Belua, daughter Karen Eichmann Plague, brother Lloyd, spouse Nancy Fairbanks, a grandson Mark Grandy, and a brother-in-law Carl Crow. Arrangements are with Major Erickson Funeral Home and Crematory, 111 North Pennsylvania Avenue, Mason City, Iowa, 50401, 641-423-0924, www.majorericksonfuneralhome.com. J. Donald, known as Pete Craven, March 22, 1936 to March 15, 2021, Mason City. J. Donald, known as Pete Craven, 84, died surrounded by his loving family on Monday, March 15, 2021, in his Mason City home. Family will be greeting the public from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. on Monday, March 22, 2021, at Hogan Bremer Moore Colonial Chapel, 126 3rd Street, Mason City, Iowa, in honor of Pete's life. A scriptural wake service with a time for sharing will begin at 6:30 p.m. Monday, March 22, 2021. Family will have a private burial at Elmwood St. Joseph Cemetery in Mason City, Iowa. A public mass of Christian burial will be held at a later date. Pete was born on March 22, 1936, the son of Don and Sis Hull Craven of Mason City, Iowa. He was a graduate of St. Joseph's High School, class of 1954. Pete was drafted into the Army in 1958. Before being shipped out to Augsburg, Germany, he married Mary Cosingfield at Fort Dix, New Jersey, on April 30th, 1959. The newlywed couple lived together in Germany until Pete was discharged in 1960. From this union, two daughters were born. After living in New Jersey for several years, the family moved back to Mason City, Iowa. Pete was first employed as an auditor for Agri Grain Marketing and was later employed as the manager at the Farmer's Coop, Grafton, Iowa, for 30 years. He retired in 2000. Pete was known as a kind and genuine man who was always quick with a smile. He was an avid golfer since the age of 10, and most days you could find him at Highland Park Golf Course, where he was a member for over 50 years. He was also the secretary treasurer for the men's club, volunteered with the junior golf program, and received the Shining Star Award for outstanding service. He even scored a hole-in-one 4 times. He was a devoted husband, father, grandfather, and friend to many who will be greatly missed. Those left to cherish memories of Pete are his wife of 62 years, Mary, daughters Lori, spouse Mark Long, Lisa Craven, spouse Austin Johnson, grandchildren Paige Florschutz, Brooke Florschutz, siblings Judy Craven, Susan, spouse Alan Ertl, along with numerous extended family members and great friends. Pete is preceded in death by his parents, his parents-in-law, as well as several of Mary's siblings. Pete's family would like to thank Mercy One at North Iowa Hospice for the wonderful care they provided, with a special thanks to Rob Grayson and Jessica Peterson, Hogan Bremer Moore Colonial Chapel, 126 3rd Street, Northeast Mason City, 641-423-2372, colonialchapels.com, Alan L. Book, Forest City. Allen L. Book, 67, of Forest City, died Tuesday, March 16, 2021, at Mercy One Medical Center, North Iowa, in Mason City. A gathering of friends and family will be held from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Saturday, March 20, 2021, at the Scott Funeral Chapel, 505 North Clark Street, Forest City, Iowa, 50436. Masks will be encouraged and social distancing practices are still being encouraged. Burial of cremains will be held in Madison Township Cemetery, Forest City, Iowa. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to Pheasants Forever or Ducks Unlimited. You can contact the family with online condolences at www.scottfuneralhomes.com. Scott is spelled S-C-H-O-T-T. Phone number 641-585-2685. Judy Charlene Olinger, Clear Lake. Judy or Charlene Olinger, 77, of Mason City, died Wednesday, March 17, 2021, at her home. Arrangements are pending at Ward Van Slyke Colonial Chapel, 310 First Avenue, North Clear Lake, 641-357-2193, colonialchapels.com. Moving to the sports page, Prep Sports District approves league departure. Mason City leaves CIML, request new conference be formed, by J.C. Smith, Globe Gazette. Mason City schools athletes are one step closer to competing in a new athletic conference. With just one question and a quick unanimous vote by board members at Monday night's meeting, the district withdrew from the Central Iowa Metro League and requested the Iowa High School Athletic Association form a new conference of 10 teams that are all current CIML schools. The IHSAA did not return a call for comment on the board's decision or what the next steps will entail. Board members and District Athletic Director Tracy Johnson discussed the move at the board's committee of the whole meeting on March 1st. Johnson noted that the district's record of success against the Des Moines suburban school districts that are part of the CIML is low. Quote, when you get junior high kids at games and they see scores and we're struggling and getting beat by 35 or 40 night in and night out, it's tough, end quote, Johnson said at the meeting. Quote, the kids don't want to be a part of that, end quote. Mason City is one of the smallest schools in the CIML. Broken into 3 conferences now, the CIML drafted a proposal to become a 2-conference league starting with the 2022-2023 academic year. One conference would be dedicated to the 9 suburban teams, and the other conference would be the rest, including Mason City. The 10-team conference would still play at least 1 basketball game each against the suburban league, according to the proposal. The district has been trying to leave the CIML for a few years. In December 2019, it asked to join the Northeast Iowa Conference, but was stopped as that conference was looking to reorganize as well. Board member Jacob Schweitzer sought clarification on Monday night on exactly what the resolution did, formally withdraw from the CIML, ask for the creation of the 2 new conferences, and invite the other 9 schools to join. Quote, this gives clear intent of what we're up to, end quote, responded Superintendent Dave Firstage. Our next sports article, where they are now. Ole continues his hardward success. Former Newman Catholic standout coaches walk key to title, by Gunnar Davis, Globe Gazette. Justin Ole, that is spelled O-H-L, and I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing it, Justin Ohl just wrapped up what might be his best winter on the hardwood, and that's saying something when you've been as much success as he has. As head coach of the Waukee boys basketball team, Ohl coached the Warriors to a 61-50 win over Johnston on Friday in the Class 4A state championship game. Ohl has coached at Waukee, the seventh largest school district in Iowa, for a decade now, and has led the Warriors to the state tournament six times. Before that, he was involved with the Drake University men's basketball program as a player, graduate assistant, or coach for 14 years. But Ohl's story actually starts in Mason City at Newman Catholic, a private school with a student body population of just over 600 students. Quote, "I think Newman really made me into the person I am today," Ohl said. "It helped me develop my value system and my character on a daily basis. I was able to play football, play basketball, golf, and I was in a variety of things in school. Just having that really well-rounded experience has really helped me later on in life," end quote. A 1997 graduate of Newman Catholic High School, Ohl was one of the best athletes that ever walked the halls of the school. He is the program's only two-time All-State boys basketball selection, 1996-1997, and is still the all-time career points leader with 1,661 points. Not only was he a standout in basketball, but in his first 2 years of high school, Ohl was also a large reason why the Knights won the state golf championship in both 1994 and 1995. Ohl's high school basketball coach Randy Fischels says he's not surprised by Ohl's success at Waukee. After all, succeeding is just what he's done everywhere. Quote, "He was a great guy. Of all the years I coached, that was probably one of my favorite teams," end quote, Fischels said. Quote, "There weren't any egos on the team. Justin could have been a guy who was cockier than hell, but he wasn't. He was just one of the guys. He treated everybody on the team equally," end quote. Treating everyone equally might be something that has carried from his time as a standout at Newman Catholic to his time as a four-year letter winner at Drake to now as a leader standing on the sideline. This season, Ohl had to find a way to get the four Division I players on his team on his roster to work together equally as one. With multiple stops and starts to the season, he finally had his boys playing their best basketball at the right time of the year, and it paid off with the first state title in program history. Quote, "It was great. We had been to the semifinals and got to the finals last year and came up short," Ohl said. "This group was really motivated to finish off their careers with a state championship," end quote. Just because Ohl's home has been Des Moines for the past couple of decades, it doesn't mean that he doesn't miss Mason City. He still checks in on Newman Catholic scores, and he has even gone and supported the Knights baseball team when they've played at Principal Park. Whenever the Waukee boys basketball team travels to play Mason City, Ohl brings his team to Newman Catholic beforehand for a quick shoot around and walk through. Quote, "I think our players enjoy it," Ohl said. "They've enjoyed going back and seeing some pictures, seeing where I played. I think they get more of a kick out of it than anything," end quote. Despite time spent at one of the largest school districts in Iowa and Division I Drake, Ohl still looks back at his time at Newman Catholic fondly. Quote, "I really enjoyed my time at Newman. I was very fortunate to do a variety of things at the school," Ohl said. "They really gave me a chance to learn about myself. I really have some great memories and great friendships looking back on it," end quote. Our last sports article, prep football. I've coached tremendous young men. GHV's Shoemaker retires after four decades of coaching, by Gunnar Davis, Globe Gazette. Darrell Shoemaker has given over four decades of his life to the game of football, and he's got quite the resume to show for it. But even the best know when it's time to step away. Shoemaker, a member of the Iowa Football Coaches Association Hall of Fame, retired from the position of head football coach for Gardner Hayfield Ventura in February. Quote, "I think there comes a time in everybody's career where you just feel like it's time to do that," Shoemaker said. "I kind of felt that way before Christmas, and it just kind of kept going that way," end quote. Shoemaker spent the last 2 years of a 42-year coaching career as the leader of the GHV program, where he had previously coached in the late 80s and nearly early 90s. Current athletic director Matt Graham, who played under Shoemaker at Gardner Hayfield, jumped at the opportunity to hire him as head coach 2 years ago. Quote, "He turned around two programs that were perennial strugglers, Garner Hayfield and Vinton Schelsberg, end quote, Graham said. Between the last two seasons, Schumacher coached the Cardinals to an 8-9 overall record. Schumacher started in 1978 and spent 6 years at Benton Community. Then he went to Garner Hayfield and spent over a decade in the school district. In 1991, he led the program to its first and only state championship. He and his brother, Delos, were the first brothers in the state of Iowa to both earn state championships as head coaches. Delos took Lake City to a state title in 1990. After his time at Garner Hayfield, Schumacher spent 2 years at Spencer, 6 years at Vinton Schelsberg, and 8 years at Oskaloosa. He then coached offensive line at Iowa Central Community College for 7 years before returning to GHV for his final two seasons. Some of his favorite memories include coaching a long list of talented players and watching them grow into men, but the opportunity to coach both of his sons, Vaughn and Ben, will always hold a special place in his heart. Quote, I've coached tremendous young men, Schumacher said. I could go on and on for hours. The people that I coached with and the people that I coached, I just feel lucky to have been able to be around them. That's why I got into the job. I didn't get into the job for wins and losses. You've got to love what you do and take the highs and the lows, because in coaching, we're the highs and there are lows, end quote, Schumacher continued. Quote, but let me tell you, I would do it again over in a heartbeat, end quote. Graham, who is also stepping down as athletic director, hopes to have the two positions filled at the April school board meeting. Moving to the Nation and World section, officials express divergent views. U.S.-China meet in Alaska in test of nation's troubled ties, by Matthew Lee and Mark Thiessen, Associated Press, Anchorage, Alaska. Top U.S. and Chinese officials offered sharply different views of each other and the world on Thursday as the two sides met face-to-face for the first time since President Joe Biden took office. In unusually pointed remarks for a stayed diplomatic meeting, Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Chinese Communist Party Foreign Affairs Chief Yang Yiqi took aim at each other's country's policies at the start of 2 days of talks in Alaska. The meetings in Anchorage were a new test in increasingly troubled relations between the two countries, which are at odds over a range of issues from trade to human rights in Tibet, Hong Kong, and China's western Xinjiang region, in addition to policies over Taiwan. Blinken said the Biden administration is united with its allies in pushing back against China's increasing authoritarianism and assertiveness at home and abroad. Yang then unloaded a list of Chinese complaints about the U.S. and accused Washington of hypocrisy for criticizing Beijing on human rights and other issues. Meanwhile, Blinken pressed China to use its, quote, tremendous influence, end quote, to convince North Korea to abandon its nuclear program, hours after the North said it will ignore U.S. offers to resume negotiations. Our next article, House OKs Help for Dreamers, Workers, Prospects on Gateway to Citizenship are Bleak in Divided Senate, by Alan Fram, Associated Press, Washington. The House voted Thursday to unlatch a gateway to citizenship for young dreamers, migrant farm workers, and immigrants who've fled war or natural disasters, giving Democrats wins in the year's first votes on an issue that once again faces an uphill climb to make progress in the Senate. On a near party line, 228-197 vote, lawmakers approved one bill offering legal status to about 2 million dreamers brought to the U.S. illegally as children and hundreds of thousands of migrants admitted for humanitarian reasons from a dozen troubled countries. They then voted 247-174 for a second measure creating similar protections for 1 million farm workers who have worked in the U.S. illegally. The government estimates they comprise half the nation's agriculture laborers. Both bills hit a wall of opposition from Republicans insistent that any immigration legislation bolster security at the Mexican border, which waves of migrants have tried breaching in recent weeks. The GOP has accused Democrats of ignoring that problem and President Joe Biden of fueling it by erasing former President Donald Trump's restrictive policies. While Dreamers win wide public support and migrant farm workers are a backbone of the agriculture industry, both House bills face gloomy prospects in the evenly split Senate. digest, two more Biden picks confirmed Washington. The Senate on Thursday confirmed California Attorney General Xavier Becerra as President Joe Biden's health secretary, filling a key position in the administration's coronavirus response and its ambitious push to lower drug costs, expand insurance coverage, and eliminate racial disparities in medical care. The 40-59 largely party line vote makes the 63-year-old Becerra the first Latino to head the Department of Health and Human Services. The $1.4 trillion agency encompasses health insurance programs, drug safety and approval, advanced medical research, substance abuse treatment, and the welfare of children, including hundreds of Central American migrants arriving daily at the U.S.-Mexico border. Without opposition, the Senate also confirmed veteran diplomat William Burns as CIA director on Thursday, giving him control of the nation's premier spy agency as the U.S. government confronts threats from China, Russia, Iran, and elsewhere. Investigators will consider hate crime, Atlanta. Police said Thursday that, quote, nothing is off the table, end quote, in the investigation of the deadly shooting at two Atlanta massage parlors, including whether the slayings were a hate crime. A 21-year-old white man, Robert Aaron Long, is charged with murder in Tuesday's slayings. Six of those killed were women of Asian descent. Quote, our investigation is looking at everything, so nothing is off the table, end quote, Deputy Atlanta Police Chief Charles Hampton Jr. said at a news conference. The Cherokee County Sheriff's Office said it also was investigating whether the killings were hate crimes. President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris changed their plans for a previously scheduled trip to Atlanta. The pair postponed a political event in favor of meeting Friday with Asian American community leaders. Briefly, immigration. The U.S. government has stopped taking immigrant teenagers to a converted camp for oil-fired workers in West Texas as it faces questions about the safety of emergency sites. It is quickly standing up to hold children crossing the southern border, the Associated Press learned. Corruption allegation. A Myanmar construction magnate with links to military rulers said he personally gave more than $500,000 in cash to deposed leader Aung San Suu Kyi in a broadcast on state television aimed at discrediting the ousted civilian government. Unemployment. The number of Americans seeking unemployment benefits rose last week to 770,000, the Labor Department reported Thursday, a sign that layoffs remain high even as much of the U.S. economy recovers. Chauvin trial. Attorneys at the trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin, who is charged in George Floyd's death, moved closer to seating a jury Thursday, choosing three jurors hours after clashing over how much the panel should hear of Floyd's own actions. Census. States under pressure to redraw congressional and legislator districts, but facing a delay in the release of the needed data, may be able to get the numbers in an outdated format in August, more than a month earlier than the planned date for their official release, a U.S. Census Bureau official said Thursday. Housing. Homelessness in America was on the rise even before the coronavirus pandemic dramatically dragged down the economy, according to a government report. The new report shows that 580,466 people experienced homelessness in the United States on a single night in January 2020, an increase of or 2.2% from 2019. Our last article, Coronavirus Business Impact, Jobs in Peril, Pandemic Left Scars on Global Job Market, by Paul Wiseman and Alexandra Olson, Associated Press. Esther Montez's house cleaning job at the Hilton Back Bay in Boston was a lifeline for her, a 31-year-old single mother with a 5-year-old son. The pay was steady and solid, enough to pay her bills and still have money left over to sock away savings for her child. But when the pandemic slammed the U.S. economy a year ago, it swept away her job and millions of others. Since then, Montana's has stipend away money from her son's savings to meet expenses. She's getting by on unemployment aid and for the first time has applied for food stamps. Quote, the truth is I want my job back, and quote, Montana's said. Getting back the job lost to the pandemic is likely to prove a struggle, even as viral vaccines increasingly promise a return to something close to normal life. The coronavirus seems sure to leave permanent scars on the job market. Millions of jobs lost likely won't come back, especially at employers that require face-to-face contact with customers, hotels, restaurants, retailers, entertainment venues. If the habits that many picked up during the pandemic, working, shopping, and enjoying entertainment from home, persist when the health threat has receded, demand for waiters, cashiers, front desk clerks, and ticket takers may never return to their previous levels. poorest workers face biggest impact. Jose Maria Barraro of Mexico's ITAM Business School, Nick Bloom of Stanford University, and Stephen Davis of the University of Chicago have concluded that 32% to 42% of COVID-induced layoffs will be permanent. The recession has been especially cruel, victimizing people at the bottom of the pay scale. Lael Brainard, a Federal Reserve governor, said last month that the poorest 25% of American workers were facing, quote, depression-era rates of unemployment of around 23%, end quote, in mid-January, nearly quadruple the national jobless rate. Service workers had long been thought to be safe from the threats that menaced factory employment, foreign competition, and automation. But more and more, as employers have sought to save money in a time of uncertainty and to promote social distancing in the workplace, machines are reaching beyond the factory floor and into retail restaurants and hotels. Tamara Jameson, for instance, came back to a changed job when she was recalled to work in June as a front desk agent at the Paris Las Vegas Hotel and Casino, owned by Caesars Entertainment. Her hours were cut from 40 to about 32 a week, resulting in a pay cut of about $700 a month. Just 26 of 45 workers on her team were brought back. Existing self-service kiosks used to be optional for guests checking in. No longer. Now agents must direct guests to the kiosks and intervene only if needed. That means fewer commissions for room upgrades. Guests can request them on their own. Jameson wonders whether the front desk operation will eventually be eliminated, the job lost as guests use keys on their smartphones to go straight to their rooms. The pain is widespread. In the Chinese city of Zhuhu, northwest of Shanghai, Guan Li, a convenience store owner, said he hired four out-of-work relatives but had to lay them off after sales fell by half. Now he and his wife run the shop themselves. Quote, people just don't want to buy, end quote, he said. Guan, who is close to 60, and his wife plan to retire because the shop may no longer cover their costs, hoping for pent-up demand. In Egypt, Mohamed Gamal used to earn a decent living working 6 days a week at a cafe in Giza, twin city of Cairo, but pandemic restrictions and dwindling business shrank his work week and slashed his income by more than half. It didn't help when the government banned, quote, shisha, end quote, the hookah water pipe that populars across the Middle East and a major moneymaker for cafes. Now he shares a room to save on rent. Quote, I just work 3 days a week and this is not enough even for a single person, end quote, said Gamal, who is 31. In New York, Bill Zenker is envisioning a comeback after being forced to close his luxury gym, Grit Bang. He's raising money to launch an at-home fitness business in the fall, which will mean eventually hiring to support an online business, including customer service and supply specialist. Still, Zenker hopes that his Manhattan gym, known for its cocktail bar and backed by billionaire Tony Robbins and others, will eventually come roaring back. Quote, there is so much pent-up demand, Zenker said. People after class are going to want to hang out and socialize. It's like after prohibition, party like there's no tomorrow, end quote. However things shake out, millions of displaced workers will need to find new careers. Reviewing the job outlook in eight major economies, McKinsey estimated that 100 million workers, 1 in 16, will need to change occupations by 2030. Researchers at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology warned last year that low-paid workers without college degrees who've lost their jobs, quote, may suffer significant hardships as they seek new work, potentially in occupations where they have no experience or training, end quote. And that does it for today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Friday, March 19th on Iris. I'm your reader, Erin. You can access today's reading online at iowaradioreading.org. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you have a wonderful day.